supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Borderline personality disorder. It's difficult. It's complex. It leads to a great deal of suffering. People with this disorder are often called difficult, attention-seeking, dramatic, but their actions indicate something more complex. Their lives are often ruled by substance abuse, eating disorders, suicide attempts, self-mutilation, but very little is offered in the way of explanation. Their behavior is echoed within their own minds, which can be clouded by black and white thinking, right or wrong, good or bad. And this often divides relationships, makes all relationships unstable, and inside their sense of self is shaky at best. We know many of those suffering report being sexually abused or abandoned as young children, but the real causes remain unknown. Is the disorder genetic? Can it be prevented? And what are some ways we can help those whose lives are complicated by borderline personality disorder? Joining me today are Talia Lewis and Edie Mannion. Lewis is in recovery from borderline personality disorder. She helps facilitate support groups, teaches seminars, and consults people on BPD. Mannion is the director of the Training and Education Center of the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Both of you, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dan, for having us.
Later on, we'll hear from Professor Marsha Linehan, who developed dialectical behavior therapy, a treatment for personality disorder that shows great promise. Well, if you want to join our conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Perhaps you or a loved one is suffering from this disorder. Perhaps you've got moods that are unstable. You've got a history of difficult relationships. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Edie, let me start with you. There are actually 9 criteria for this diagnosis. We don't need to tick off each one, but just give us a feel for what we as mental health professionals need to see before we consider someone with this disorder.
Well, they say there's 256 shades of this, but if you're asking what are the primary components, Dr. Linehan, who you'll be talking to shortly, really says that at the core it's emotional dysregulation and difficulty controlling impulses. But that it has many other components, such as difficulty with intense anger, self-destructive behavior, self-injury and suicide attempts. Self-injury, by the way, means that the person's not trying to die. They're just trying to injure themselves as a way to cope with intense emotional pain or to communicate to others how much pain they're in. It can also include this feeling of emptiness, which is often sort of idiosyncratic sometimes for this disorder, a feeling of just feeling empty.
Let me bring up something with that word, Edie, because, you know, I've been treating people for 40 years, and I've heard that word come up in my office often. And every time a patient of mine has used the word, that patient has been a woman. I have never had a male patient use that word.
Interesting.
And you know, when we look at borderline personality disorder, it's predominantly women, yes?
I think the ratio is 3-1 for diagnosis, but that may be because men are not being diagnosed. They often may have a form of it that ends them up in the criminal justice system, so they don't get treatment or diagnosis.
Makes sense. Often those with borderline have a history of neglect or abandonment, trauma, childhood abuse. So when we look at this, I mean, it sounds like PTSD.
Well, I know Judith Herman, who wrote the book Trauma and Recovery, believes that it really is complex PTSD. And I've been working with families over the last 15 years, and I know that, you know, a lot of in the literature, a lot of people report neglect or abuse or trauma. There's also the issue, though, I have heard of people who have the hard wiring for this, however they may get it, are quite sensitive, and life can be traumatizing when you're highly sensitive. Mm-hmm. So there's also, so we don't want to ignore the trauma, but I think it's a continuum.
I remember many years ago when Prozac first came out, and I don't know if you recall, it seemed to work for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Peter Kramer on the show who wrote Listening to Prozac, and I said, so what's going on here? I mean, why did, and he said, look at it this way. Everybody's born with a different amount of Teflon on their nerve endings. Mm. And what this does is adds a layer of Teflon. And what you're describing, Edie, is people who have no Teflon or not enough Teflon. So they're so overreactive.
Yes, that's a great metaphor.
It really is. Well, I'd like to spend some time with you, Talia.
Okay.
I'd love to get to know you as instead of all these labels, you know, I want to put a human face on it. When we spoke with you before the show, you said you first noticed feeling different as early as kindergarten, and you felt different from your family, too. How so? I mean, what's that like for... How old are you in kindergarten? 5 years old. I mean, what's that like for a five-year-old?
Actually, I had 3 years of kindergarten, so I don't know. I could have been five, six, or seven.
What's it like to feel different? Must be scary.
You know, to define it is difficult. I didn't know anything different. This is just always how I felt. I didn't feel like I fit in with my family. I didn't think I fit in with their interests, with the things that they like to do, just did not seem consistent with the things that I like to do. So I really always felt like I stuck out, like I didn't belong, like I was born into the wrong family, like perhaps I'd been adopted.
But I want to push you here a little bit. What's that like for a little kid to feel that way?
I think for a little kid, again, I'm remembering this now with an adult mind.
Right.
So it's really very hard to define, but I felt very lonely as a child. I felt as though not just, you know, not belonging in your family would then get generalized to really not belonging anywhere. And that carried on to having a very difficult time connecting with peers. So it was just this general feeling of just isolation and of really not fitting in anywhere in this world.
And when you talk about lonely, I mean, that's got to be capital L.
Capital
lonely.
L.
Yeah.
Capital L.
You started back then with what looked like attention-seeking behaviors. You wrapped tape around your arm and told the kids that that it was broken. The fact that you needed attention, craved it, makes me wonder what you were getting at home back then. What was your family like?
You know, my family, they're very, very loving. My mother desperately wanted to have children, and she absolutely adored my sister and me. So sometimes with borderline disorder, you can actually have what's called good enough parenting. And I think I pretty much got good enough parenting. But my parents were also both raised themselves in a time that the attention doesn't necessarily go to the kids. Kids are kind of to be seen and not heard kind of thing. So they weren't as active, perhaps, as I would have liked them to have been. I think a lot of things happened that they missed with me They were socialites. They spent a lot of time entertaining and being entertained. And I think their life was very much consumed with that and not very much consumed with their children. So a lot was missed, and I got to the point where I would do absolutely anything for attention. And it definitely got to the point where negative attention was a whole lot more appealing to me than positive attention.
We're talking about borderline personality disorder. If you or a loved one have experienced these wide-ranging emotions, difficulty in relationships, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're going to talk to Talia a little bit more about what was going on inside and her suffering, but she's not the only one. When something this dramatic and this dangerous appears in families, it affects everyone. Before the show, we spoke with Camille. Her daughter's in her 30s. And has borderline personality disorder. Camille participates in a support group for families with Edie and Talia.
If it wasn't for the support group, I think I'd really feel alone. You know, I have a great partner, and he's been there for me, you know, for 10 years. He knows my daughter very well. He loves her. But I think for a parent, here's somebody I decidedly brought into the world. And, you know, at times, she doesn't want to live. She hates me. At times, her world falls apart. At times, she'll walk into a room with my friends or family, and havoc will break loose. You know, one of the things in one of the books I'm reading about this disorder is like it's someone driving a truck out of control and is driving over everybody's front lawns and into property, and they're just complete reckless. And so when I see her shattering relationships all around her, even people I love, it's just really stressful.
Well, that was a parent of someone with borderline personality disorder. Talia, what was your relationship like with your parents as you got older, as things got worse? I mean, in middle school, things really escalated for you.
As I got older, my relationship with them, I think, became more and more strained. As an adolescent, I was very, very angry, and that came out. And I remember, I have very few real solid memories of growing up. But what I do remember was that there were absolutely a lot of arguments. And perhaps my parents saw it as just the typical teen and the typical arguments that go on with a typical teen. I remember them being a little more escalated than that. And you know, maybe they do too. I don't know. It's not something that we discuss. I do remember that I would tantrum even when I was older, even at, you know, 15, 16 years old. You could find me lying on my floor screaming and kicking a closet door in.
Well, you were doing more than tantruming. I mean, when you were 9 years old, you were trying to dock your teeth out with a screwdriver.
Yes, when I was 9 years old, I think that was the first time that I really realized that I did not like what I looked like. I didn't like my skin, I didn't like my hair, I didn't like my teeth. And I had the opportunity to change my teeth, so I took a screwdriver and a hammer, and I broke my front tooth with the screwdriver and the hammer. I mean, it was an opportunity to destroy something that I hated, and I was what I really very much hated.
It must have hurt like hell.
It hurt. I think that was my first taste of self-injury, and I didn't know that it was going to have the effect that it had. It wasn't like I thought to myself, oh, let me do something that's going to hurt. I did something that hurt and realized that in the process, not only did I get to destroy the teeth I didn't like, but I got some relieving pain from it, too.
Relieving pain. Edie, Is what we're hearing, I hate to use the word typical, is it what we see?
Yes, I think it's very typical, and I think that's actually how Dr. Linehan got into treating and researching this disorder, was she was originally studying suicide attempts and self-injury. And it's really, you know, an attempt to cope with unbearable emotional pain, which can consist of fear and shame and self-hatred and rage and hopelessness. That just gets to a point where I've heard people say, I just want to jump out of my skin.
True.
Tell
you. True. You felt all of those things.
Absolutely.
At what point did your parents' mother become aware that you were in trouble?
My parents didn't become aware that I was in trouble until school made them aware. I had a very hard time in school all through, I mean, as long as I can remember, school was never a comfortable and easy place for me to be because I was very afraid of my peers. I didn't know how to interact with them. I didn't know how to be with them. I didn't know how to be natural and talkative. I was lacking a lot of those social skills. So school was very, very uncomfortable, and I was also lacking a lot of academic skills. When I got into high school, that's really when things fell apart. It was the 10th grade, and my school called my parents in, asked them to come in for a conference. My parents arrived, and the first thing that they were told was, we have to expel your daughter. My parents were floored because up to this point, they really had very little idea that there were any issues. And they were told that I was exhibiting some very bizarre behaviors. I was cursing at the teachers and making faces at them. I was refusing to do any work. I was extremely disruptive. I don't remember this, though. I have no memory of this. The only thing I remember from the 10th grade was February 21st. I overdosed on a bottle of sleeping pills in the lobby of my high school.
Did you want to die?
No. I don't think I wanted to die. I think at that point I was so incredibly desperate that death felt like an option. However, if I really, really wanted to die, I would have done it by myself in my bedroom, shut my door, and no one would have been the wiser. They would have found me once it was too late. I did this in the lobby of my high school. So, yes, a part of me wanted to be dead. A part of me wanted to be saved. A part of me wanted to be noticed.
I'm trying to wrap my mind around what it was like to be you. You know, we use labels like disorders of identity or lack of identity or lack of self, and they might fit you back then. But what was it like to be you as a 10th grader?
It was terrifying to be me as a 10th grader. I was scary and I was scared. I was intimidating to other people, and I was intimidated by everybody around me. I was caught in this pull of insanity, really. I didn't know who to trust. I didn't know what I could trust. I was also, at this point, I was pretty paranoid. By the time I had this overdose, I had already been very, very involved in drugs by this point, and I was already self-injuring by this point. But it was very scary being me. And I can't even say, a lot of people say when they talk about borderline disorder, they talk about there being a lack of identity. I need to make it clear that it's not that there's a lack of identity. I think people with borderline disorder have an identity. The identity that they usually identify with, though, is really a pretty evil identity, that bad side of you. Like, you know, the way I am today, all put together, this is a facade. When I was acting out yesterday, that's the real me, the bad me. So they have an identity. It's just that identity is more of them being evil than anything else.
And I
felt that.
And if you were more put together, I mean, everybody has a bad side and a good side, but they all get united around something called a self, you know, and there's these different parts of our personalities, but you just identified with one.
Well, it's very fragmented,
yeah,
I think, this disorder. And I absolutely identified with that evil part of me. I mean, that was who the real me was. All the other stuff, it was really little bits and pieces of other people that I was taking on and incorporating it into myself.
We're going to have to take a break. We have a lot to do because we've got a lot of callers, and I want to get to what turned things around for you, obviously. Something did. We're talking about borderline personality disorder today on Voices. My guests are Edie Mannion. She's co-founder of the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. She's trained in dialectical behavior therapy, and we're going to hear more about that later. And she does individual and family treatment sessions. Talia Lewis, who we've been hearing about, is in recovery from BPD, and she helps facilitate support groups. She teaches seminars, and she consults with people on BPD. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Clear Mobile Internet supports WHYY. Clear's 4G WiMAX network covering Philadelphia is designed to allow users to stream TV, movies, or public radio all over town. Clear, now covering Philadelphia. Details at clear.com.
I'm Marty Moscowain. At WHYY, we value our editorial independence, and we believe you do too. A rigorous editorial process ensures that the stories you hear are fair, balanced, and accurately reported. That might seem old-fashioned, but it's still the best way to ensure that you can trust what you hear. Help WHYY remain your trusted source for news and information. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online now at whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, FX, presenting a new season of the FX series Damages, starring Emmy Award winner Glenn Close. The season premiere airs tonight at 10 p.m. on FX. More information at fxnetworks.com.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about borderline personality disorder with Talia Lewis and Edie Mannion. Lewis is in recovery from BPD, and she helps facilitate support groups. Mannion's co-founder of Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Let's go right to the phones. Our lines are booked up. We've got Joan on line one. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Well, I am interested in talking about the impact that this has on the whole family. My mother actually had a narcissistic personality disorder with borderline tendencies. And I have a 17-year-old who was diagnosed early on as having a sensory integrative dysfunction. As you talk about the no Teflon, he had, I mean, truly from the time he was little, no Teflon on his nervous system. So he displayed a lot of the sensory defensiveness that goes with that dysfunction. And received a lot of taunting and a lot of bullying at his lovely little protective private boys school in New York City. And when he was in sixth grade, there was an art festival in which his self-portrait was hung. Portrait had been done in December, and when I looked at it, I almost fell on the floor because it had graveyards and dead bodies behind this sweet little beautiful face that he had drawn of himself. We sold our apartment in less than a month and moved, and he is much happier now in the big public school that is very, very diverse and very wonderful. But he still displays the rage and all of the things that I saw in my mother, and the self-harm was the real reason that we left New York. He had started cutting. And
What are you doing for him now?
Well, he sees a psychiatrist regularly, and he is on medication. I can't tell, frankly, how much worse it would be without the medication. We're still living on a tight wire, and everybody's ready to snap and angry all the time. And his younger brother was born for no purpose except to bring joy into the world. He was, you know, happy and always laughing and goofing around. And that child has been gone now for years. I looked at a picture of him the other day, and it made me cry because I thought, you know, I haven't seen that kid in 5, 10 years. So the impact of this on the whole family. And, you know, family therapy is all well and good, but if you've got a rageaholic or somebody who's as volatile as this and as destructive, wants everybody around him to feel as miserable as he feels.
Well, I let me interrupt, and I want to turn to Edie, because you're going to hear now in this next half of the show more and more about something called dialectical behavior therapy. You know, medication is all well and good. There is no medication for borderline personality disorder. There are medication for some of the symptoms that go with it, depression or anxiety or what have you. But you're going to hear more about a specific kind of treatment that's only done by people with specific training, and certainly this is the gold standard for treatment with borderline. We're going to hear if there are any others. But let's hear first from Edie about this specific issue, and we'll talk specifically about family therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Joan said family therapy is all well and good, but you've got a kid who's out of control.
Yeah, I think until he's able to and wants to work on controlling that, what you can do is probably what you're already trying to do, is to cope with daily life in this sort of minefield, and to try to get the support and information and education and skills for how to respond to this in a way that it might, if nothing else, not make it worse.
Certainly traditional family therapy is not the way to go.
I don't think at this point. Down the road, perhaps, if he's able to have more control, which he, you know, has to learn and want to learn, it's more a matter of maybe you and your husband. And the sibling issue is a huge issue. I hear all the time the effect on siblings, also adult sons and daughters.
So you're talking about something for Joan and her family more around teaching, training,
yes.
what we call psychoeducation.
Yes. You know, not to say that family therapy is never valuable, but I think that comes after people have had some skills training and support and information. And if the person is going to be in the room, hopefully, you know, there's some ability to control and talk rather than just rage and, you know, lose it in the session.
Jonah, I hope that was helpful. Thanks so much for your call. Go on, Talia.
I just wanted to say one thing. I know that when a family member is raging like that, it can really appear as though they're doing that just to destroy your day and to shake everyone in the family up. But I think it's very, very important to be aware that anger, when it comes so impulsively like that, it becomes something that's really very, very difficult to control. And a lot of times, individuals, at least with borderline disorder, they have the inability to really be able to define their emotions and to label their emotions. There's actually a term for that called alexithymia, which is the inability to label and process emotions. And it's something that we commonly find in borderline disorder. And with that, with the inability to be able to put words to the pain, can come this explosive rage. And it's not intentional on the part of the individual with the disorder. And if families realize that, it can make it a little bit easier if they know where it's coming from.
And I would suggest that after the rage, after the outburst, there's tremendous guilt and remorse and self-loathing, I would imagine.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We've been talking about this dialectical behavior therapy. Let's hear some more detail about that. Dr. Marcia Lenihan is a professor at the University of Washington. She's the pioneer researcher who's developed this highly successful treatment for BPD called dialectical behavior therapy. The thing is, she never set out to do this. The treatment came out of her work with suicidal patients. Lenihan was interested in treating highly suicidal patients with traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, and which teaches people new ways of thinking. But as she profiled her patients for research grants, She saw many other issues. She told our executive producer, Mike and Scott, what happened next.
I had actually never heard of borderline personality disorder. And a reviewer in one of my grants said, these people really look like borderline personality disorder. And so I said, oh, well, I'll look at that. So I read up on borderline personality disorder and discovered that the entire time I had been treating that group. I got interested in them mainly because they're, first of all, they're highly suicidal. They have a 10% suicide rate, so they're the highest risk of any group that I know. And second, they're really incredibly interesting to work with.
Talk about the treatment you developed, which is dialectical behavior therapy.
Well, the treatment I developed started out as a straight cognitive behavior therapy. I mean, I really wasn't planning on doing anything else except that behavior therapy is really a technology of change. And these individuals must have change. But on the other hand, I realized that there had to be acceptance simultaneously and that you had to balance or synthesize or bring together into one place at the very same time radical acceptance, while at the very same time you focused on change. That's where the term dialectical came from, because it's the synthesis of opposites, looking for the truth in both sides.
Can you give us one example of how this works with maybe one specific behavior? Because it sounds like it's something that's impossible to do almost.
Well, let's just take a really intense emotion that may not fit the facts, okay? So let's say that you're feeling extremely hurt that someone doesn't like you, and let's say that the hurt is out of all proportion to how much they do or don't like you. The first thing you have to do is radically accept that you actually are hurt and be mindful of that emotion. But also, you then have to move to trying to regulate the hurt and regulate actions related to hurt so that you don't feel hurt and then reject a friend and walk out on a relationship when it either wasn't accurate or could have been repaired. So you have to do both. You have to accept the emotion and also work to regulate it.
How does this treatment typically look like for people? How long are people in treatment? Do they have a team of therapists?
In our research trials, we have treated the most severe. So I'm going to tell you how the treatment looks with very severe. So with the very severe, the treatment to date has been once a week skills training, which is a group where you teach individuals skills in emotion regulation, skills in distress tolerance, which includes crisis survival, which is how to get through a crisis without making things worse, how to accept a life that's not the life that you want. We teach mindfulness, and we teach interpersonal effectiveness. So that's the skills training. Then we have individual therapy, which focuses very specifically on targeting behavior in a very specific order. So, for example, a DBT therapist would always target suicidal behavior before they would do anything else. So if you come in and you're suicidal, that will be the focus of attention until there's reason to believe the risk has gone down or the probability you're going to do something again is lower, at which point you move to the next target, which is behaviors that interfere with therapy. First of all, therapy doesn't work with dead people, and so you've got to have as your primary obligation keeping the client alive. But also, therapy doesn't work with people who don't attend therapy, don't come to therapy, quit therapy, don't pay attention to therapy, sleep through therapy, or drop out. So your second focus has to be on making sure that there's a working alliance in the treatment. And after that, it's really focused on the client's own goals, whatever they may be. Now, the next two parts of the treatment are one, particularly with severe, but with most clients, may call their therapist for coaching. And we're great believers in doing coaching in the real world, because learning how to be effective in it while you're at a therapy session is really not what therapy is about. Therapy is really about how to be effective in your everyday life. So therapists do telephone coaching within, you know, whatever limits the therapist may have. And finally, therapists meet in teams and their supervision to make sure that a therapist actually stays within the treatment, because it's very easy to drift away from an evidence-based treatment.
Looking ahead, what do you hope, what are you focusing on next, and what do you hope to see in terms of treating borderline personality disorder?
Well, I told my students that I expected them to reinvent DBT. So, you know, let's hope 5 years from now we'll have something a lot better than our current DBT, and we'll get enough, you know, research funds to go at the treatment and figure out what can we get rid of in the treatment, what do we want to keep in the treatment, you know, why does this treatment work so well, and how can we make it work better? So what I'm hoping, you know, we will build is a really rigorous, top-of-the-line research group who will really improve our treatment.
That was Dr. Marcia Linehan, who's at the University of Washington. She's the pioneer researcher with borderline personality disorder and has developed dialectical behavior therapy. Edie Mannion, this seems this therapy seems pretty labor-intensive.
Well, it actually does take a lot of time and energy, but it's very rewarding because I don't know, I use the metaphor when I tell people about this that if you go into rocky terrain of mountains, you would not take a family sedan, you would probably take a Jeep or a Hummer or something like that. And I think people with this disorder are in such amounts of pain and maybe have developed habits of behaving that can be difficult for therapists to know how to deal with. And if they don't have that support system and this structure, they often end up reacting to their own emotions, and it, you know, it's bad for both.
We the word motivation has come up in this discussion a few times, and I want to turn to you, Tilly, about yours. You were in therapy with a social worker, and you were doing what you do. You were acting out in therapy and making demands and threatening and so on and so forth. She fired you.
Well, I want to say she fired me. She gave me a choice. Actually, at this point, it's also important to be aware that by the time I was in treatment with a social worker, I had already served my time with years of inpatient long-term treatment in a private psychiatric hospital, because back then, it wasn't like it is now where you go in and out and you're in for a week or two and out. When I was in the hospital, I was in for a year at a time. I think my shortest hospitalization was 3 months. My longest was a year. And this went on for about 4.5 years. And then when I was done with that, yes, I was in treatment with a social worker. I was still highly suicidal. I would call her day and night. I would call her from, you know, I called her once from a bridge telling her I was going to jump.
Did you want to get better?
Initially, absolutely not. I wasn't sick.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wasn't sick. It was everyone else. It was my parents. It was...
What changed?
It was really... What really started to change was when I was in the hospital. And I remember actually thinking to myself, I'm tired of being sick. I remember thinking those words, I am tired of being sick. And it was at that point that I eventually, and I don't remember when because I don't remember my last discharge from the hospital, but it was during that period after my last discharge where I was never institutionalized again that I went into treatment with the social worker who was actually my social worker in the hospital as well. And so that was the first signal that I was done.
I can't tell you how many times I have heard that story. For anybody who's lived through adversity, there's a moment where they say, I want to live, or I don't want to be sick, or just there's that moment, and then everything begins to turn around. You were just listening to Talia Lewis. She is a person in recovery from borderline personality disorder. She helps facilitate support groups. I'm also joined here in the studio by Edie Mannion. She's a co-founder of the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. She's trained in dialectical behavior therapy, by the way, and treats many with borderline personality disorder. We're going to be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY FM.
President Obama addresses the nation and the State of the Union, a battered economy with a gaining stock market, healthcare crises and an aging boomer population, two wars with 500,000 American military and contractors, homeland security, education, the environment. The President's State of the Union Address, an analysis with NPR reporters and editors, Wednesday from NPR News.
Wednesday night at 9 on WHYY.
On Tell Me More, we talk politics, culture, money, parenting, and even hear wisdom from a few unexpected sages like boxer businessman George Foreman.
Money is a good thing, but every morning you have to get up with something no one else in the world gets up with. That face you see in the mirror, you gotta love it.
Join us for distinctive and surprising conversations next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about borderline personality disorder with Talia Lewis and Edie Mannion. Lewis is in recovery from BPD. Edie Mannion is trained in dialectical behavior therapy, which is really the gold standard for treatment of borderline. Listen, I'm going to summarize several of the calls that I see up on the board. One wants to know the difference between someone who's highly sensitive and BPD. Another one wants to know how you diagnose BPD. She's got an 11-year-old who may have it. So the question is, how do we get to this label, and is it important? This is my question. Mm-hmm. Is it important to have a label? I mean, it's not like we're surgeons and we could get to a specific problem with a specific treatment.
Right, and especially when the label is such a horrible name, which I think they're working on changing to things like emotion regulation disorder and moving it out of the personality disorders. But the sensitivity issue, I also find a lot of people with this are gifted, intellectually gifted, and that sensitivity also goes with giftedness. So where's the line between the sensitivity of giftedness that then drifts into some of these behaviors? The way it's diagnosed is basically somebody just sitting down with someone and asking them these 9 criteria and the extent to which they've experienced them and how long. And I also think it's important for people to talk to people who know the person, which is not always done. So, you know, in case people may not remember things, may not be motivated to be totally honest, hearing it from other people could be very, very significant.
So we have somebody listening who's got an 11-year-old who might have it. So what now for this parent and the 11-year-old child?
Well, I'm a big believer in specialists for whatever you're dealing with. So to find somebody who may specialize in this in adolescence, and then hopefully this person would talk to this young man, and I don't know to what extent he will be able to sit there and answer questions, but I think when it's a situation with a child, then talking to the parents is critical.
Dialectical behavior therapy seems so, what's the word, intellectual, cerebral, almost, and it involves metacognition, and you know, you're asking people to look at their own minds and emotions. Mm. You can't ask an 11-year-old to do that. So well, what kind of treatment's available?
I think, I wish we had Dr. Linehan on the phone to find out what people are doing in other, you know, areas for this group, age group. But I just read a study about teaching children to work on their thinking so that they're less likely to get depressed when hard things happen. So, and they had good success with this cognitive therapy with children in a classroom setting. So I think the skills have to be adapted, and some of them are fun and not totally intellectual, you know, but they do involve paying attention to your experience.
Well, consistent with both of these parents, I want to play another clip with Camille, because as you referred to earlier, I guess both of you, Edie and Talia, that these family groups involve education. Camille's daughter, as we said earlier on, has borderline personality disorder, and she's taking the course that we've been talking about and gives an example. Recently, her daughter asked her for help with directions, but got very, very angry when Camille printed out several maps for her.
I don't want to read maps. I don't like maps. Maps don't help me. They may help you. They don't help me, you know, and she just went off, completely off. And I'm like, okay, first she asked me for the help, and, you know, now she doesn't want it. Let's say previously my reaction would be, you know, I can't believe you're telling me this. You just told me you wanted me to help you, and, you know, and I spent all this time, and, you know. And I said, okay, you know, if you think they're not going to be helpful to you, you know, I understand maybe maps don't work for you. You know, I allowed her to have that moment and say, maps don't work for me. I didn't react to sort of my frustration with the fact that she just told me to help her.
That was Camille, who we heard from earlier. His daughter has BPD, and we hear now how through psychoeducation, not traditional talk therapy, she's learning techniques about de-escalation. I want to bring up this issue of motivation, the shame behind the diagnosis. And I want to address you, Talia, that you spent years denying that it was you, thinking that it was other people. When you look back on it, because we've got a couple of people here who are bringing up the issue of people who aren't motivated or people who refuse to accept the diagnosis. So when you look back on it, is there anything you could have imagined that would have been helpful for you to accept your diagnosis, to be more motivated for treatment?
I hate to disappoint you, but my answer is no. I really don't know what would have made a difference. I mean, for me, treatment was very much forced on me. And then I was infuriated by it. Now I've got to say thank you, because I wouldn't be where I am today. If I had been left to just do traditional outpatient or to do DBT and go to groups, I don't know if I would have done it. I don't know if I would have cooperated and if I would have been motivated to do it. One of the things that I do know is that with this disorder, there is a lot of dependency goes along with it. And that was one of the damaging things with inpatient treatment, is I did become very, very dependent on the people that were part of my treatment team. And I think that's part of what kept me in inpatient treatment so long, because being terrified to being abandoned by those people. But that can kind of be utilized in outpatient as well. And if the rapport and the therapeutic alliance is stable and effective between therapist and person with the disorder, if that same kind of dependency evolves, it can be managed in a more healthy way than an inpatient, but it can keep that person motivated and wanting to come back because of the relationship with the therapist.
Edie?
One of the distinguishing features of dialectical behavior therapy is we spend a lot of time being trained in what they call pretreatment contracting, which means that you could spend weeks or months, you know, if someone is willing to at least show up at your office or talk to you on the phone, kind of negotiating with them about what they want. And, you know, her famous line is, when they're going through this negotiation process, is to say something irreverent like, why wouldn't you want to be in a treatment where if you want to kill yourself, you can? She uses a lot of irreverence mixed with warmth and genuineness to kind of help people really take stock of what they want and how hard they're willing to work. And she doesn't just coax them in. She oftentimes will sort of play devil's advocate. So we don't assume that if someone shows up for therapy, they're ready for change or they're ready for DBT. You know, we spend a lot of time helping them figure out what they are ready for and whether DBT is the right for them.
Edie, what's it like for you? These can be pretty taxing, pretty dangerous, demanding, threatening. What's it like for you?
Well, before I learned DBT, it was very scary, I think, and I did a lot of wrong things. So I would say that now that I believe that it's critical to have at least one other person that you talk to about what you're doing or not doing or why you're doing what you're doing or how you're feeling, it helps you, like Dr. Linehan said, stay in the frame.
How can, and I want to ask both of you, how can someone who wants treatment for themselves or a loved one, how can they find someone who practices dialectical behavior therapy? Edie?
Well, there's a website, of course, called behavioraltech.org, just like it's spelled, behavioraltech, T-E-C-H.org, which is her website where you can find a DBT therapist in your state. And then, you know, read up on it, understand what it is so that you can ask that person questions, because some people will say they're DBT therapists but may not be practicing all of the components or may not have had the intensive training. Anyone listed on her website had the 10-day training, though.
You want to add anything to that,
no,
Julia?
No, I actually never went through DBT.
Really?
So, really.
You have no right to be better.
I have no right to be better.
Do you feel you still have borderline? Is it chronic for you?
When I look at all nine of the criteria, when I was diagnosed, I met all nine of the criteria. And when I look at them now, I still think to myself, oh my gosh, that's me, that's me, that's me, that's me. But the difference is now is those criteria don't have a hold on me. I have a hold on them. I absolutely manage them. And I always have to manage. Yeah. I always have to manage myself.
In recovery.
In recovery.
In recovery, that really is the right word.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Talia, you've been great. I appreciate your openness and your honesty.
Thank you very much for
thank
having
you.
Me.
And Edie, you too.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks for the work you do. So my guests have been Talia Lewis and Edie Mannion. Lewis helps facilitate support groups, teaches seminars, and consults with people with BPT. Mannion runs the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeast Pennsylvania. Next week, we'll be talking about apologies. You can reach us at whyy.org. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Gita Simons and Stephanie Maroudis produce the show. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. Sadly, we're going to have to say goodbye to him. Jonathan, you've been great. Thank you so much for everything you've done for us. And I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
You've been listening to Voice.